Before we start with today's episode, I want to address a common challenge that I've noticed among HVACR professionals. They often struggle to keep up with the advancements in heat pump technologies. That's why here at the ESCO Group, along with the HVACR Learning Network, we have an amazing library of courses to equip you with the essential skills for handling today's inverter-driven heat pumps. And better yet, we're offering free access to the first two chapters of our most popular course on the fundamentals of high-performance heat pumps. Check out the link in the show notes to get your free access.
There's a series of things that the EPA has to accomplish, and they have to engage industry and come up with rules to say, okay, one of the things here, we have to accomplish X. How are we going to do that? And they put out a rule for that. And there have been three rulings thus far under the AIM Act, different ones. Again, we've been talking about them on this show quite a bit, actually. The phase down schedule is one of them. The technology transition rule is another. And then most recently in October, the subsection H rule, which established leak rates for HFCs. Now, there is something called the CRA, the Congressional Review Act.
This episode is brought to you by ESCO, a leader in HVACR and building science education. Since 1988, ESCO has been setting industry standards, providing certification and validation tools, and delivering expert training resources to help professionals excel. With a strong commitment to innovation and sustainability, ESCO is shaping the future of the HVACR industry through accreditation, assessments, and professional development. Learn more at www.escogroup.org.
Do you have the knowledge to work with the next generation of refrigerants? ESCO Institute can help you learn the information you need with the low GWP A2L refrigerant safety course. Did you know newer refrigerants are less harmful to the environment? Did you know there are new standards for the transportation of low GWP refrigerants? Did you know most A2L equipment will require refrigerant detection systems, and you will be required to use no spark, no arc tools and equipment? Get the facts. These are just some of the things you need to know to work on new equipment. Take the online course to learn more. The ESCO Institute Low GWP A2L Refrigerant Safety Course is interactive and engaging and will prepare you for the Low GWP A2L Refrigerant Safety Certification Exam. You will find the Low GWP A2L Refrigerant Safety Course on the HVACR Learning Network, the industry's leading source of online and digital content. Visit hvacr.elearn.network today.
Well, howdy, partners. Welcome to the Wild West of Refrigerant Regulations. We're so glad that you joined us today. We have got so much stuff to talk about, and we want to welcome Tom Grunstra to the crowd. How you doing, sir?
Howdy, folks.
For those of you that don't know Tom, he's been in the industry for decades. He's come to ESCO to help us get through some of these transitions and work on training and education in a much broader aspect from our industry. And going through the things that you need as educators and as contractors and as technicians. So you're going to see Tom out a lot with us. We'll be at the National HVACR Education Conference. We're going to be at AHR next week. There's going to be a lot of things going on for 2025. And we're here. Well, howdy, y'all. How's it going, Mr. Tebby? And wherever you're joining us from, we want you to let us know, you know, there's a lot of things happening in this industry. And as a community, we're going to get through it together. And so every week, we're going to continue joining these different conversations. Some of them are going to be difficult. Some of them are going to be challenging. And some of those are going to be getting updated potentially along the way. And so we want to make sure that you have the resources to be successful in these transitions. Hey, what's going on, Froggy? All right, so, Fortnite, I'm sorry. I thought that was Froggy Beluga coming in there. Kendrick, hey, glad to have you here. This is going to be really interesting, Kendrick. So if you have any questions along the way, definitely let us know, because there's going to be a lot of, I would call it maybe controversy here coming up when we start talking about refrigerant regulations. A lot of miscommunication within the social media. Hello, Paul, how's it going? And so we're going to address some of those things. So we want to kind of start off the conversation talking about things from a very high level, right? So let's start out with a very broad perspective of where we are for refrigerant regulations. So let's kind of start at like an international level. This is one place that Jason and I like to kind of keep our ears going out to, because there's a lot of buzz internationally about refrigerants, especially these HFC phase downs and phase outs in some places. And so if you're not already aware, HFC phase downs and changes have been happening for a lot longer period internationally than they have here in the U.S. So when we talk about regulations, Jason, it's really more of like an international and federal and even sometimes statewide regulation, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a variety of levels that these things happen at. They typically start, like you said, something at the international level, and everyone kind of feeds off of that, where there's this bar that's set for everybody, and then it kind of trickles down into the individual countries or states or cities in that sort of way. But you're right, yes, it does kind of start at that international. Everybody comes together and they agree this is where we should be, and then they take it and run from there.
Exactly. So if we start at the international level, this is, you know, a decade or longer in progress. And the international perspective, they look at, just like we have here in the United States, they look at the high GWP refrigerants. And so in 2015, they took an analysis of what refrigerants were the most common, the most used, and what had the highest GWP. And of course, we see things like 404 that we recognize here in the U.S. for a low temp refrigerant. 410A, everyone knows that one for air conditioning. 134A for automotive air conditioning, as well as medium temp refrigeration. Well, for the entire EU process, they were wanting to get down much lower and faster. And so by 2030, they've set their deadlines for what their refrigerant transition is going to look like. Now, when we move over to the U.S., we began this transition. Really, 22 is where we really started on it. Right now, we're in the middle of this. We're at a 40% reduction through the Kigali Amendment as well as the AIM Act. And that's really why we're here today, is to talk about changes in regulations from the federal and from the state so that people have a really good understanding. Now, Tom comes from, particularly from the manufacturing side of our industry, and has seen how regulations have changed manufacturing. And Tom, for a variety of different manufacturers, I'm sure it's been a bit of a challenge to reline up and retool going from things like R410A into R32 and R454B. I would imagine it takes at least a few years to be able to test equipment and then to be able to put them into new tool and die and then into production. Is there kind of like a time frame? Is that where that falls into?
Well, there's no doubt that that's going to be an issue for every manufacturer having to do that, because they definitely, when you change refrigerants, it's a significant change. You're changing your refrigerant piping characteristics. It may even change your compressor sizing. It's going to change the operation control. You start to talk about the higher efficiency, which is where everybody's being driven to. And now you're talking about controls that are controlling the expansion valve, the compressor speed, the entire operational, as well as the fan speeds, so that all those algorithms and all that programming has to be completely redesigned in addition to the hardware. So yeah, it's a pretty big bite to take off in that in our industry. So the scary thing is, once you go in that direction, right, if they take it away, what are they going to do now? Right.
Exactly.
That's that conversation that's going to, I'm certain, happening behind the scenes at every single manufacturer out there of R32, R454B equipment that's currently in production.
Exactly. You know, we've pretty well eliminated the manufacturing of R410A, at least in our residential light commercial. Our VRV, VRF equipment, they've got a little extended period of time. So there's some products that, you know, that we looked at before with like the technology transition rule and such. But we've had a lot of concerns here recently. Hey, thank you for joining us from Brazil. We're grateful that you've joined us today. And yeah, I know, once you get it in your blood, it's just part of who we are. And so understanding what's happening internationally is so important to all of us. And I would really love to know, you know, where the refrigerant transition is in Brazil. Are you seeing a lot of it? Are you hearing a lot about it? Are you following the U.S. and what trends are happening here? We're always curious of where other pieces of the world are. So one of the things that is a topic of conversation at the moment, now remember, we're not going to take political sides in any way, shape, or form. We're going to have a discussion on facts today, and we have a lot of information we'll be able to share, and so we're going to encourage you to use some of these documents that I'll be sharing here in a little while to do some of your own research to see where we are, because as you are aware, there are a lot of things happening federally that can affect our industry. And the AIM Act has been a very important piece of the HFC phase down. And there is the potential for things within that to be challenged. And one of the concerns, one of the calls that we get at the office is it all going to change? Are we going to go back to R22? I'm ready for R12. When's it coming back? And we really want to help clarify that. So, Howard, would you help explain if we got to a point where we were ready to try to repeal something like the AIM Act, what does that process even look like? It's not simply a matter of a president of any, whether they're Republican or Democrat, of any side of the aisle. If a president was to decide, okay, we're going to focus on this, what does a process even look like that? And what kind of time frame would we even think about?
I'd be happy to. I'd like to just say real quickly, Tom Grunstra, welcome to our team. We're very fortunate to have you. Many years in manufacturing, so it gives a different perspective, and it's going to be some great things coming out of ESCO with our team.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Clifton, to answer your question, I want to first say I'm not a lawyer. I don't try and even pretend to be one on YouTube. So what I'm going to try and do is state what I know as fact, and let's talk about what would happen if someone wants to propose a bill or repeal a bill.
Any bill.
I kind of feel like sometimes we need to go back to watching the children's show Schoolhouse Rock so people understand how a bill is.
Very basics.
So very basic. So when we talk about making a bill, okay, in the case of the AIM Act, it started with Senator Kennedy out of Louisiana. He's a Republican. He found a co-sponsor from the Democratic Party. They wrote a bill together. Once they found that they liked it, they sent it to the House, went back to the Senate, and then it was eventually signed, ironically, by President Trump.
Correct.
Okay. If you wanted to repeal it, you can't just go ahead and say, well, we're undoing this with executive order.
Right.
You would have to actually introduce a new bill to repeal that bill. So once again, this would have to start in either the House or the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
You would have to, you would find a bill number on it. And there actually is HR number right now with someone who's, and Jason, I believe it's out of Florida, who's proposed to repeal the AIM Act.
No, it's not the AIM Act. It's subsection H. That's the subsection H rule. Yes. Okay, we'll cover that in a little bit.
We'll get to that in a minute. But then it would have to go to the appropriate House or Senate committee. So in this case, it's going to wind up going to a work committee that will eventually wind up going to the EPA as well.
Okay.
So we're going to review the bill. And Jason, you could do this a little better, but basically we're going to review the bill, debate it, possibly amend it. So if it started in the House, it goes to the Senate, may get amended, go back, vice versa. Once they come up to consensus, there's going to be a committee that may ask for industry stakeholder meetings, which could be the EPA.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And we're going to discuss that in a minute when we get down to the state level, because there's actually some states that have a open stakeholder input currently, like right now, that is looking for industry input, particularly from that state. And I'll show you what that's like. Hey, Katie, thanks for joining us again today. Hey, man. Hey, yeah, grateful that you're hanging out with us here today from Ghana. Appreciate you being here. All right. So we started this process, House, Senate, we bounced around a little bit, we've debated it, we've decided, okay, we're going to put committees, we're going to ask for input, and we're going to talk to different agencies, we're going to have a little period of time. All right, we get to it. Okay, now I think we're going to ready to do this. So can I hand this off to the president yet to sign off on it?
No.
Okay.
It has to. Here we go. There's a process here. So okay. Congress doesn't really have a process. It's basically they need 218 votes, which is 50% plus one to pass it through. When it gets to the Senate, they get to debate. And the debate can go on indefinitely, as long as there's something to say and someone to say it. So what you need in the Senate to close debate to send it to a vote is what we call cloture. It's 60 votes to close the debate period and force a vote. Once the debate has been closed, then again, it's 50 plus one. You only need 51% of that. But in order to get it to that, you need 60 to shut down the debate period. And that is the filibuster. So it's kind of complex. It's a Senate rule. It's not a federal rule. It's not a rule for Congress. It's specific to the Senate.
Right.
And it's how they close the debate on the bill and send it to a vote. There is no means or method to close debate. There was nothing on the books that said, hey, how can we force a vote on this bill? How can we say, all right, debate is over, time to vote? And right. that's where the filibuster came in. It was all the way back in 1917 or something. And it used to be 66 votes. And then in 1975, they changed it to 60, which is 3/5.
Sure.
So
to be able to just get past it, even if they're
to close the debate and force a vote. Once you get to the vote point of it, once the debate has been closed, it's 51 again, 50 plus one.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Oswaldo, appreciate you hanging in again, man. Glad to have you here.
I know for the international listeners, they're going
to... Yeah, they're like, what are these people crazy?
Belize is one of my favorite places. I enjoyed going there very much.
Awesome. Yeah, so if it gets confusing, you can understand how things just don't move very slow here in the U.S. Even if we say that they're going to, it really doesn't. It takes a while. And then, if needed...
Clifton, can I say something real quick? Yeah. So Jason and I have had this conversation. Well, there's no federal requirement for a filibuster. It's a Senate rule.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing stopping the Senate from removing the rule. The thing is, so they could go to a 50 plus one and just have 51 votes.
Yeah.
That being said, both parties, when they've been in power, have threatened to remove the filibuster, but their fear of doing it is when they lose power, they won't really have a say.
Yeah.
So we don't want to say that the filibuster will stop something.
Yeah.
But right now it would.
Okay. All right. And so at some point, after we're done bouncing back and forth, we get to that point, all right, and we're ready to, okay, now we have something that is complete. Now we can actually hand it back over to the president, and from there...
It can be signed into law, yes.
It could be signed into law. All right, so that's where we want you to see what it would take from this federal perspective, because after that, after the president would sign that into law or veto it, because it can go either way, in this case, would probably sign it into law, then it would be basically assigned to the federal agencies, and it's not just a federal agency. We're talking about all federal agencies, right? So it's not something that would be specifically directed towards one. It might have more involvement with one, but everyone would now be required to follow that law. So it could take a period of time. So it's a challenging thing to do. You're going to hear a lot about it in the next few months. We just want you to understand what it looks like, what it actually takes, and then it is a process. It's not as simple as something coming across the desk and signing it, and boom, we're back to R22. Doesn't happen that way, especially as Tom mentioned, because we have all of our manufacturers that have spent millions and tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, to prepare for these transitions, and they're in the middle of that. So,
before you get to the local there, I'd like to cover that CRA real quick.
We should. I had a couple slides, and it's my own fault I didn't have them in there, because there is an additional thing in here that's very interesting.
Yes. So when the AIM Act, again, the AIM Act is legislation. It passed bipartisan through the House, through Senate, signed by the president.
Right.
It was put into law, and then now it's up to the EPA to issue rulings to accomplish all of the things that are laid out in the AIM Act. So there's a series of things that the EPA has to accomplish, and they have to engage industry and come up with rules to say, okay, one of the things here, we have to accomplish X. How are we going to do that? And they put out a rule for that. And there have been three rulings thus far under the AIM Act, different ones. Again, we've been talking about them on this show quite a bit, actually. The phase down schedule is one of them. The technology transition rule is another. And then most recently in October, the subsection H rule, which established leak rates for HFCs. Now, there is something called the CRA, the Congressional Review Act. And it gets kind of convoluted, but what it basically says is any legislation that is passed in the last 60 days before a new president comes in is open for review by Congress.
Right.
They can overturn it with just a simple vote of no confidence. No additional legislation required. It's just this is overcumbers, burdensome, whatever, financially not sound. They can put whatever on it, take a vote, and it's overturned. So, but again, it would need to go through Congress, and then it would have to get that 60 votes there in the Senate to close debate, and then it would have to get to 51 in the Senate and then go to the president to be signed. So that is what has been filed from Florida at the moment, was the CRA, the Congressional Review Act, was used to try and repeal the subsection H ruling that came out in October. So it may happen in a month. It may not happen at all. It might happen in 6 months. We don't know, but there is a bill sitting in the House as we speak. We just don't know where it's going to go at the moment. And it only affects the subsection H rule at the moment.
Correct.
And if I could just interject, one thing is we're talking about repeal, but when we talk about passage, we get a lot of questions. Why does this stuff take so long?
Mm-hmm. Jason was alluding to a few things. So in December of 2020, when President Trump signed the AIM Act, why are their provisions not done yet?
Well, when you start looking at it, they have to have time to analyze it, understand what this means. They have to seek industry input. So they have these stakeholder meetings in person and online. After they get industry input, they may put out a proposed rule. And then there's a comment period, then a final. So all this doesn't just happen overnight. It takes a great deal of time to make certain it's done right and it doesn't impact anyone adversely.
I want to also point out that all the people listening and watching today, you can also take part in this process. You are allowed to go on and comment on these things when they are released, when they're published in the register and there's a 30 or a 60-day comment period. Anyone can go on there as long as it's relevant. You can't say, I think this stinks. They're not going to take that seriously. Give a reason. Hey, this will impact X, Y, or Z. Everyone's entitled to go on and make it a comment on these things.
Well, subsection H, we actually had a show and we had some social posts where we're encouraging industry stakeholders to participate in the open comment period for subsection H. You know, another interesting fact, Jason, about the congressional repeal, out of all of them that have been ever submitted, only 8% have actually been passed. So it's very, very
small. It's a high bar, right?
It is. So, you know, from the federal aspect, there could be some changes that could take place over a period of time. But we've also had states looking at it from their own perspective. Because if you think about why is so many different things happening at a federal level, not just for our industry, but for many industries, right? Our current president is looking at ways to reduce the cost that is placed on the federal side for managing different aspects that affect states and people in particular. So there are many states that have already taken it upon themselves to focus on these different things like refrigerant regulations. And so we're going to kind of transition into that right now. And I'm going to pick on a few different states and give you resources to be able to dive deeper into what these states are, because there's actually an entire cluster of states that have became an organization called the U.S. Climate Alliance. And so with the U.S. Climate Alliance, it's a variety of different states. There's 14 states that have now participated in that are looking at this as a state level going, okay, if things are moved from a federal level to a state, we need to make sure that we're ready for that. And so they actually have. They've been diving very deep into what that looks like. And so there is a map. I encourage all of you to grab this map. Let me see if I think I put that in the notes over here.
It's got it at the bottom,
NASRC.org, and there's a U.S. Climate Alliance map, and that shows the progress. So of those 14 states, that's all of these that are in different colors, and you can see that there are some that have taken taken faster actions than what others have. So if we look at this from a perspective of what the states are starting to do or have already done, we can always hop over to California, right? And I'll put this in the show notes here. Here is an actual link. I'll put that out there in the chat, actually, if anyone would like to have direct contact for this document. So this is a fact sheet from the state of California on what they're looking at for their refrigerant requirements. We keep hearing about how California is having their own refrigerant requirements. We're like, well, what does that look like? Well, here's what it is, right? It is a phase down like we've looked at in the AIM Act and the Kigali Amendment, that sets standards for refrigerants based on dates.
And GWPs.
And GWPs, right? So if we look at this, we know that a lot of things have happened for refrigerants, especially in new equipment. We're going to see some things in some states that affect service gases as well. So when we look at the state of California with their new climate legislation, right? It's their Senate Bill 1206. January 1st of 2025, so a few weeks back, they were putting a restriction on R404 and R405 in commercial refrigeration and supermarkets. Okay, basically banning that refrigerant from coming into the state because of its high global warming potential, 2,200. They're also going to be in January 1st of 2030, they're going to have their own R410A phase down schedule because of a 1500 GWP requirement. So 5 years from now, R410A is going to be the focus of refrigerants. So even the newly manufactured refrigerant that's available or equipment that could be brought in is now going to be starting to look at to be banned for it. And then they've got another one of January 1st of 2035 to get down to 750 GWP. So they're a little different than what we've seen in the technology transition rule, but it's following a similar design, right?
Okay, so this is for bulk HFC. So what basically what this is saying is you can't bring in tanks of refrigerant that exceed those GWPs on those dates. So beginning January 1st of this year, you're not allowed to bring 404A into the state of California to put into commerce, to put into a unit. 1500 in 2030, meaning you won't be able to bring in a tank, a virgin tank of 410A to service your legacy 410A equipment. So again, these are bans on bulk refrigerant import based on a GWP. And there are three target dates there, January 1st of this year, January 1st of 2030, and then January 1st of 2035, where we see it go all the way down to 750. We're going to lose 134A there. We're going to lose a lot that, you know, as we move out. And this is not the only state doing it.
No, no. That's why I wanted to bring this up and make these documents available for everyone. So this is a two-sheet document. I'll put that link in there. Let's go take a look at Washington real quick. All right. So Washington has an entirely different design. So it's part of a much broader pollution reduction program that the entire state is focusing on. And so within that, what they're actually doing is they're looking at a variety of different applications, primarily automotive. So I'm going to skim through all of the automotive so you can see where they are refrigerant-wise. It's going to take me just a minute because this is kind of slow to pass through here. So they're just looking at total emissions, right? So they are part of this entire group of states. And some of the states are creating the time frame that looks very, Paul, we're going to get to New York in a minute. Don't you worry. You're actually probably the one we're going to spend the most time on, because most people think in the past, we've always thought of California as being the most progressive with regulations, and that is not at all the case. New York currently is going to be the one that we're going to be looking at for the most interesting regulations when it comes to refrigerants, because it's quite interesting. So we're actually going to be doing that right after this one. So I just want you to see, though, it's not just like a state or a couple states. It is a lot of them. And this entire presentation is available to you from the state of Washington. So they've been doing a lot of these webinars and diving into this. So what they're doing is the same thing. They're reducing the consumption of particularly higher GWP refrigerants and putting them onto a timeline. Okay. So their timeline is starting January 1st, 2024. They're going to have some for 2026 as well. And I got to find that table. I'm pretty sure there's a table.
But they were one of the first states to actually put forth. They were one of the first states to adopt A2Ls into their building code. And they were one of the first states to put out a state-level climate reduction policy.
Exactly. So right now, for those of you in the state of Washington, you actually are in this period for open comment on this topic. So they are now into that rule proposal, right? So they're looking for the comments, then they will be into the rule proposal and then a rule adoption by the end of 2025. So like we talked about, you had an opportunity to be involved at the federal level. You actually now have the opportunity to be involved at the state level to help direct where that is going. And so the link for this one, where did I put that one?
And my comment here is, don't complain after the fact if you have something to say.
That's exactly right.
I was speaking with one of the members of our team here earlier today. There's an organization complaining about the AIM Act now, and they had years to go through the comment period and everything before it passed in 2020. So talking about it 5 years later doesn't really help.
No, exactly.
And if you're going to comment, please make it make sense.
Yeah.
Going on there and saying, I think this is all stupid, that is not going to help your case.
Right.
One of the key things is contractors probably didn't spend much time getting in there. The guys where the rubber meets the road, they're putting the equipment in. They're the ones that are getting the focus of the nasty cutoff on this, worse than distributors and manufacturers are. So, you know, they really probably didn't get a whole lot of say in this because they really didn't understand the focus and get involved. So,
exactly.
Is it changes if they, right, exactly.
But a lot of the people complaining, I'll just share this, don't realize how long things have been going on. So in 2002, we started talking to you about this new refrigerant 410A coming, and it was going to be temporary. In 2010, we told you we knew 410A was going away and it was going to be an HFO. Okay, and that happened at our conference in March of 2010. 2015, the EPA talked about it at our conference. 2016, I remember Chemours broke ground on their 454B plant. So when you start talking, these are things that happened a long time ago. So everyone goes, where'd this come from all of a sudden?
It's been out there.
It's been out there for a long time.
And that's really what we're here to do today, is to help give you these resources to help you be aware of these changes. And as they continue to change, we will keep you updated on where things are, because there are some very significant ones. So here's a really good one.
I'd like to help you be part of the process. I don't want you to feel like there's nothing I can do. This is, you know, and just kick rocks. No, there's a lot you can do. There's, you can be part of the process, whether at the state level or at the federal level. There's always a place for you to put forth an educated opinion or plan on things. And we encourage you to do that.
That's absolutely right. All right, Paul, so we saved this one for you. So this actually just went to the industry January 31st, 2025. And so this is a letter from the state about the enforcement of Part 494.
Part 494, yeah.
And with 494, it's going to look at refrigerants in a similar aspect. I put the link for that in the notes as well. What they're basically doing is saying that they are going to abide by 494. And so what is 494? It is one of the most in-depth phase downs that I have seen at the state level yet. So I'll put this link in here as well. So this is, so that first one was the letter of intent for the industry. This one is the actual documentation with
the fact sheet, right?
The fact sheet itself. So what happens here is the state of New York has now put in their own. Remember when we were talking about the technology transition rule, we were talking about systems and we were talking about products. That's actually what we're going to be looking at here. So we're going to look at a variety of different industries. So for us, we're going to look at, we're not going to do this page. This is on aerosols. Remember, we did a whole class on how we use refrigerants as propellants for aerosols. So they're getting the same type of phase downs or phase outs. Foam products, all the manufacturing of foam products. Now, if you look at the bottom of page 3, refrigeration, air conditioning, and heat pumps, right? As educators, this is most of us, right? These are the things that we are actually teaching on. These are the things that we need to be the most aware of so that we can prepare our students. But we also have the responsibility for assisting in preparing the industry, because there's a lot of contractors that are completely unaware of this. When Jason brought this to me last week, I'm like, what are you talking about? And when I pulled it up, I was like, okay, we got to do a class on this. We have to do a show.
I will say this, though. This is all encompassing. So if you can think of a system, any kind of system, it falls in one of these categories somewhere. There's nothing left behind on this. They have thought this out. There was a lot of debate on this, and you're going to see some differences between this bill and the technology transition rule. This goes way beyond.
Way beyond.
Yes. And as pointed out, I will say at the moment, a lot of these systems are either not manufactured, don't exist, or they do exist, but not in the United States.
Not in the United States. So let's look at where we are, right? We know that we're transitioning as an entire industry away from R410A into R32 and R454B to get underneath that 750 GWP of the technology transition rule. New York, if you look right up here in the second block, refrigeration, air conditioning, and heat pump products and systems. So this is anything that you're going to buy from your local distributor. If we look at air conditioning and heat pump chillers, residential and light commercial air conditioning and heat pumps, including residential dehumidifier, that's absolutely us. VRV, VRF products. If we look at simply the residential light commercial air conditioning and heat pumps, January 1st of 2025 for the chillers, and they give that additional 12 months like we did in the technology transition rule to get through the residential light commercial products, with a GWP of 700. So it's very similar to the technology transition rule. The GWP is just off a little bit. So where it gets very interesting is when we look at other products. If we look in the future, just a few years, let's go down to the bottom And this is where it's going to get very interesting, Paul, in New York. January 1st of 2030. 5 years, that's a little bit. But in 5 years, residential, light commercial, air conditioning and heat pump in the chiller sector of 20 GWP. And by 2034, 9 years, a GWP of 10.
A GWP 20.
Yeah,
of 10.
20 of 10.
Yeah.
So I was going to say that needs some discussion, right?
On that, yeah.
Well, that one's 100 GWP.
Yeah. So if you look at the first date, that is the date from the technology transition rule, 2026 to 700 GWP. That is what's currently federal law. They take it a step further and say by January 1st of 2034, these systems have to have a GWP 20 of 10 or less. Let's say for residential, like commercial, air conditioning, heat pump.
All right. So this is the interesting part where we really wanted to have Tom's perspective on this. When we talk about residential light commercial heat pumps, that's 2034. Let's step back even just a few years to that 2030. VRV and VRF, January 1st of 2030, 5 years away, a GWP of 10, that eliminates every refrigerant that I know of except for some HFOs and naturals. Am I correct?
I don't know what they'd use. I was sitting here shaking it, my head inside, you know, trying not to, yeah, what? What are they going to use? What refrigerants are available? And you and I have had a little bit of a discussion about this. And we have all these concerns and worries about the A2Ls. And where do we go to get a GWP of less than? And that because we don't even have a refrigerant yet, manufacturers can't even be pre-designing equipment until there's a refrigerant that they can make use of. So the refrigerant has to go through this entire process. Or we're using the refrigerants that we currently have that are zero GWP. And I think we're going to have a lot of fear in the industry to go that direction.
There is a lot, yes.
Yes.
Because when you say GWP 20 of 10 or less, you were talking about most of your HFOs, propane, isobutane, ammonia, and CO2.
So we did a show a while back where we talked about where our industry is likely to go. And I'm trying not to use any personal opinion when I talk about this product line, because it is something that is really developed internationally. And we actually seen for the very first time at AHR 2024. A year ago, we had our very first R290 monoblock residential heat pump chiller. Now, not able to meet any U.S. building codes currently, but would absolutely be a residential light commercial heat pump or air conditioner that would run on a ultra-low GWP refrigerant. So basically what we're looking at is the state of New York saying that by January 1st of 2034, the industry will be transitioned to a new type of equipment if we have not found a refrigerant that works in our current traditional split systems.
There's a lot that it would have to go through in order to meet that. You have to have UL standards, you'd have to have ASHRAE standards, you'd have to have EPA SNAP approval, and then you'd have to have updated building codes, which put together takes like a decade.
Well, I was just going to ask, I'd like to ask a two-part question. Tom, how long from a manufacturer's perspective would it take to build, test that equipment? Jason, how long would it take to change the regulations federally and nationally to do that? So, and could those both be done in 5 years?
So an interesting question, because the reality is I'm not on the, I wasn't on the production side. I understood the process. I understand what happened, but let me take and tear into it just a minute so you can understand. Because when you talk about what you can do and what experience you have with something, R32 is not a new refrigerant, right? There are manufacturers that have been producing equipment on that for more than a decade, right? Well-known manufacturers. It's not an unknown. It's already being used in other countries and by those manufacturers in other countries. And clearly, they are quicker to be able to adopt those than we have been. Now, when you talk about the production of a brand new refrigerant and then applying that to the amount of changes that need to be made in the industry, I mean, I'm looking at the air conditioner chillers with the GWP 100 limit of 20 in 2030. How many chillers out there I mean, that's crazy. I mean, that number right there just caught my eye. We're all talking about residential, but the design and change of chiller in that period of time right now to go under the GW peak. Yeah, and how is that all equipment going to be changed? Forgive me, here I go. You asked me for this. We as an industry are shorthanded. There's not enough people that are educated to do the roles of service technician, let alone all the engineering, all the design, all the installation training, application training. Okay. Let's say you can all ramp that up and get that stuff done in a year, the training part, right? By just total drop everything else you're doing. What happens to the rest of the industry when you drop everything else you're doing? It's what I see is like too many targets, right? And not enough, no way to get to them. So yeah, I mean, it's a bit mind numbing. So time-wise, if you were to put a timeline on this, let's say the manufacturers were given 5 years to do this. How much time does it take to test a system to see how many hours of operation it can run before it fails? How can you do that? How can you accelerate that? If you need to have a mean time between failure rating for something, you have to have a mean time to put it into to test it. So I can't give you a number, but I can tell you some of the limitations that are there. And keep in mind now, all that stuff has to go through and be tested and certified and qualified by whatever energy standard they also come up with by 5 years or 9 years or 10 years from now. So we didn't even get to that point. They have to produce the equipment and produce samples. It means they have to create some kind of a piece of production line to make it, let alone changing the whole thing over. So Howard, is 5 years enough? Is 10 years enough? I don't know. We're going to find out what happens with our industry already as we move into the requirements for the VRF systems and VRE systems to have to transition in another year.
And then, Jason, if you were the regulatory people, you know, from states, counties, nationally, how long would that take to get approved?
Well, as Tom mentioned, they have to build these systems and have them tested. All right, so there's a third-party lab somewhere that has to test this equipment, and they test it to a very specific standard. There are no U.S. standards to test that equipment to at the moment. You have to put a committee together and develop a standard. Then once it gets to the field, you have to have, let's say, an ASHRAE standard for the service, maintenance, and disposal. So we have to write another standard for those. Let's just say we chose propane. Well, propane has to be approved, EPA SNAP approved, for every application that it's going to be using. If we chose milk, milk would have to be EPA SNAP approved to be used in that application. So you have to have UL standards, ASHRAE standards, EPA SNAP approval, and then you have to update your building codes to allow and adopt all of these new standards. So it's like a decade-long process. And as we saw with the A2L transition, different states are at different levels. There are some states that were still using building codes from 2007, and they've had to update their standards to the modern standards to allow for the installation of these A2L systems. We're going to have to do it all over again at least New York is going to in a few years, because as you mentioned, there is a monoblock propane system out there, but by building code today, that could not be put in a residential application. There's no standards for that. It's not allowed by building code. There's a lot of changes that have to be made between now and then to ensure this transition takes place.
And Tom, you bring up, we have a great comment in the chat. It's true. They are doing this in other countries, but exactly what Jason is referring to. We can't just transfer it. Our government, we don't do that. It'd be good. We can ship the equipment over here, but if you install it, it's illegal. And then I always like to throw this in, and you know, Howard, I joked with you and Jason. Actually, we were talking about it, Clifton, today. Who is going to police this? All that stuff you're talking about, and then there are so many rules and regulations and policies and things that are now not legal. Who is going to go out to the supermarkets? Who's going to go out to the homes and say, this isn't legal anymore? You can't have this anymore. And how is that? You talk about building inspectors are already overwhelmed in this country. They already have so much on their plates that building inspectors are quitting their jobs because the pressure on them to actually have to be responsible and liable if there's something wrong on the job site, is creating an issue for them. So the stress is on people, the stress is on companies, the stress is on labor itself in terms of employment is literally crazy.
And then you have the training aspect of it. We talked about the standards and the building codes and the stat. Now you have to train the entire workforce on how these specific systems work, because they're going to work a little bit differently to help people out. So again, the change is coming.
It is.
And the good thing is there are plenty of sources and areas and people to get information from. There's so much good information out there. There's things being done at the international level, state level, federal level, and there's a lot of good information. A lot of people are stepping forward to say, listen, we have classes for this. We have this for this. There is a lot out there. So it's not something that you should feel overwhelmed by, because there's, again, a lot of great information out there.
And the reality is when we say that, we're talking about the future. All this has to be stacked and staged. This is going to happen. We talked about all the things that have to happen. One has to happen before the other. So we can put on or take off our hats from whatever position we happen to be in. But the reality is, despite the fact that a law is put in place to do something, the possibility of it literally has to take one step at a time. So exactly. I can throw the frustration at you, right? But at the same time, we can say the reason, as Jason, you're saying, the reason we can sit back and say, well, let's watch and see what happens, is because that reality has to hit home, has to be done one thing at a time. The processes will be put in place. The laws will be managed and adjusted in such a way so we don't have the stress on us.
Exactly. And that's really what we're here to do, is we're here to share with you what is available to the industry so that we can start preparing and thinking ahead. We don't want to be caught with wrong information going forward. Gary, this is exactly why we enjoy having these comments, is that, you know, we are starting to see different manufacturers talking about what these transitions would look like, what the future of our industry is going to be. And really the reason we have these conversations is to help everyone understand that our industry 10 years from now is not going to be the same as it is today, but it's not the same as it was 10 years before, right? We are always in some mode of change. And so we're here to help you have the resources you need. And Zachary, that's a great point. I was just looking at that too, because I remember Jason talking about the GWP 20 versus the GWP 100. And so there have been even some additional conversations, even just this week, on this entire 494 that has actually extended that from January 1st until, was it June 1st?
April or something, yeah. Or
April. So they've extended that by a few months to be able to allow some additional time. But there's going to be a lot of transitions across the country that may not look the same from state to state. And that's where we want you to have these resources. Because what if we go, Howard, what if we move right on over to your state of Colorado? Even Colorado, which we don't typically think of as being a progressive regulation state, has actually participated in this entire transition as well to make sure that they are prepared at the state level in case the federal gets a little, you know, challenging over the years. So in the state of Colorado, they're looking at all of the same items that we looked at through the technology transition rule, different types of equipment, different industries, what refrigerants they're using, and looking at that phase down through those as well. So I'm going to skim through here as these pages are not going the fastest.
Listen, I'd like to just interject something. My number one comment I get from people, they go, I want consistency. So I was told we're going one direction. Now we're going to go another direction. So I'm going to use a really silly metaphor, but it's the Super Bowl this weekend. Imagine you're in the fourth quarter, and there's 14 minutes and 50 seconds left, and the ref blows their whistle and says, new rule, the game ends at 14, the quarter ends at 14 minutes and 50 seconds in the middle of the game. And you're like, I had 10 seconds left, and I have the ball on the one. That's how a lot of people feel. They're basically saying, you've been telling us now for 5 years, here's where we're going, and now we're not sure where we're going. So what people want is consistency. And I'll just give you this. I told some people who aren't in the industry, said, imagine we redid our homes, put it all new flooring, all new windows, new kitchens, new cabinets, new bathrooms, new roof. And when it all got done, we said, nope, we don't like it. Put it back the way it was. We really can't tell the manufacturers, You know those production lines that you shut down and maybe got rid of some of the equipment? Go reinvest and put that back in. There is no turning the clock back. We're moving forward regardless of what the legislation says. The industry's going to.
And on top of that, Howard, not only that, with these changes and as these changes are taking place, clearly our initiative is to create training that matches it. And the training is going to have to change as fast as the industry does. That's not a new challenge. That's the same thing we've been dealing with. Training has had to change all the way from the beginning. And the reality is things are just accelerating faster. And so we just have to learn how to turn that wheel faster and be more prepared and get that training out there to people.
I think one of the things I'd like to interject that's separate from the regulations, but it goes to the whole picture. People are afraid of change, okay? And change is inevitable. And if you look around you, artificial intelligence, we weren't talking about it 5 years ago, or autonomous vehicles. The world's changing very quick. What's happening in the HVAC industry, we have innovative systems we couldn't have dreamt of 15 years ago that exist now. We have people, the number one investment on a home improvement return on investment is high efficiency heating and cooling. Okay. Why is that important? Because just because the technology exists, you know what we don't have? The workforce to install, service, and maintain it. That's how I actually met this nice guy named Tom Grunstruck. We were talking about mini splits being one of the fastest growing segments of the industry. And one of the things that was holding back the growth was a lack of people capable of doing it. And all we're trying to do is tell everyone there, whether it be new technology, new regulations, don't let them hold you back. Those who embrace these things first, they're going to make a ton of money. They're going to thrive.
Absolutely. And that's really the point, is for us to all be aware that this change is here and it may not look the same from state to state. It's very important to know the regulations that are in your area, because we will see, particularly in the commercial refrigeration, it's going to be a very interesting time for those that are in the commercial refrigeration sector, especially if your companies work over different state lines. You could potentially see a variety of regulations from each state based on the refrigerants that you use. And so this is why we want to get the resources out to discuss. I'm not finding the one in this one. There was a section on residential HVAC, and this is primarily the commercial side. So I'm going to see if I can't.
The other thing about this show, one of the things we want to, the message to get to you is, listen, you can be part of this. You can take part of this and be heard. This is not something that has to happen over your head. We encourage everyone to be a part of this process, stay informed, and participate in the passing of it. Nobody sitting here had anything to do with this legislation. We didn't write it. We didn't vote on it. We didn't have it, but we did comment on it. And everybody can comment on it and provide your experience, your feedback, your opinion to whichever, whether it be at the state level or the federal level. Be active.
Absolutely. And so we do encourage your involvement in the industry. As we start seeing these opportunities, like we just shared with the one from Washington, where we actually have that opportunity to be able to voice our professional opinion on what transitions and what phase downs would be appropriate, we encourage you to do that. And so I'm going to share this one as well. I didn't see that section. I had it up earlier. I should have had it prepared for you all on exactly what it was for Colorado, but it's basically, as we look at the states, many of them are adopting the same or similar requirements and regulations that we've seen through things like the technology transition rule, so that even if we did have things like we talked about originally, like repealing certain portions of like the AIM Act or any other federal legislation, what it really means is that we need to be paying attention to what is happening at our state level, because the state level is always the guidance that we're looking for. And so if you are one of the states that are participating in the U.S. Climate Alliance, I threw that link in here as well, just to show that this is not a new thing. It's not like one of these pieces of legislation or partnerships that's happened overnight. You know, this one has been in play for 4 years and talks about what the entire initiative is. And so I want you to just kind of skim through, keep yourself well-educated as we start navigating these transitions. We're going to be here for you every week to talk about them. I know this was a lot of information that was shared and a lot of resources. And when Jason and I first started having this conversation, it was simply going to be about the New York regulation transition. And then we started saying, well, maybe we should help everyone understand this in case there's any misunderstandings. There's a lot of misinformation out there about what is happening with refrigerant regulations and transitions. So anyone have any questions?
One of the things I want to point out too is just because, let's say, something disappears at the federal level doesn't mean it did disappear at your state level, all right? A lot of states are adopting things that mirror the federal side of things. And if it disappears from the federal side, it didn't disappear from the state side. If your individual state does have that, like when we had the New York stuff up there and they had their technology transition type dates with the GWP 20 values, they also have a scheduled bulk refrigerant import, you know, with the different dates, 2200, 1500, 750. And so again, that's another portion of their law. And we're starting to see that pop up more and more. There's tons of states that have proposed rules as well. Maine has a proposed rule. So get involved. Comment on these rules.
I'd like to say something on the federal level. We send out a newsletter every month. There are, and a lot of people go, oh, I don't have time to read it. Well, here's the funny part. We'll take a 128,000-word document, a six-point font. It's like reading a simplified version of the IRS tax code. And we'll put together a one- or two-page summary of exactly what you need to know and put in that newsletter. Take the time to read it. Unless you want to read the 128,000 words, Jason's usually the one putting together that one- or two-page summary. So if something changes, we're going to let you know. So take the time to read it. And thank you for doing that, Jason.
As a glad to be able to do that for, again, for ESCO and for the industry at large. People do come to rely on, all right, holy cow, that was like 900 pages. What does it mean for me?
Exactly.
And here's a two-page little summary. It says, well, if you're a technician, it means this. If you're a manufacturer, it means this. If you're a distributor, it means this.
And don't be afraid. You have local representation in your state. Make sure that you reach out to them because they don't know what's happening. They need your input.
They're not the ones out there fixing the systems, installing the systems. You are. Right. They're not the ones teaching the curriculum. You are.
Absolutely. Well, gentlemen, I don't see any other questions. I think we've rattled everyone's brain enough. They're probably going, what did I just watch for an hour? I'm
more confused. Clifton.
Absolutely.
Is everyone listening coming to join us at the National HVAC Education Conference? Because next month, we're going to be talking about this and a lot of things.
You know, how glad you brought that up.
This is all the Wild West, right?
Million ways to learn HVAC in the West.
I can also tell you that even if we don't have questions today, there have been numerous questions coming in over the last week or so via email and phone call. So again, we do have different sites that can help answer those questions, and we will be addressing things moving forward. Again, Clifton does a great job addressing a lot of things on this show, addressing many topics. If you have a topic, again, that you're looking to get covered on, or again, send an email, we'll get on it.
Grab that QR off from this feedback form. So that's an opportunity for you to help direct this show. Let us know the topics that you want to dive into. It can be more on the regulation side. It can be more on the technical. It could be more on the soft skills. We will cater every one of these classes because we're starting to have enough people that are coming in wanting to submit classes that we can be more particular on what we have on our show every week. So it's going to be kind of crazy with conferences over the next few weeks, but I'm telling you, we have a ton of content to bring to you this year, and we want to make sure we're covering all the topics that you need the most. So do not hesitate to let us know what you need from us. That's what we're here
now,
for.
Also, the ESCO team's going to be out and about over the next few weeks. So if you see us, stop by and say hi for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got Renee and Eugene down at the symposium right now. Tom, Howard, myself will be at AHR next week. We'll have EGIA after that, and then we'll have our big conference, and we really hope that you join us. And Osvaldo, I'm glad you mentioned that. You get a chance. I'd love to talk to you more to understand what refrigeration HVAC looks like in your country. So grab that feedback form and put some info on there, and it'll send it to me, and I'll pick that up and I'll get back to you because I'd love to have this conversation. I really appreciate you hanging out with us.
And if any of you are going to the HR Expo next week, Eugene Silverstein's teaching a class. We will have a booth. But Clifton, what are you doing, 5 live shows there?
25.
Oh,
I've got 3 at the three or four at the podcast pavilions, but yeah, 25 of them. And so all of, as long as the signal is enough, is high enough, I will be live streaming at least 20 of those from different manufacturers, doing interviews on new products, new refrigerants, new technologies that are coming to the industry. And I will be streaming those just like we're doing here, but I'll actually do it in a mobile format. So I'll be doing it in portrait mode. So
question for your live stuff in the podcast pavilion, anyone listening, there's an opportunity to sit and be part of a live show. So instead of watching us on YouTube or LinkedIn, join us in as part of the show right there.
Yep, absolutely.
Clifton, are you going to wear a snazzy jacket or something? Something we can stand out?
You know me. You won't miss me on day one. Are you kidding?
Thank you for everybody for joining us on the Wild West of HVAC.
We appreciate you all so much for hanging out with us. Next week,
at the bake, so we'll be at AHR.
So we'll see what the signals look like, and we'll see what's going on. So no guarantee for next week, but after that, we will be right here for you. And everyone, have a wonderful evening. Gentlemen, thank you so much for hanging out with me today. We will see you all again next time on Did You Know the ESCO. Go.